avoid. Finally, using a sort of text-in-context argument, Marshall played his ace, the necessary and proper clause of Article 1, Section 8. Article 1, Section 8 lists various congressional powers. It concludes with a clause stating that Congress shall have power, quote, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. Maryland had argued that this clause limits congressional power, permitting Congress only to act when absolutely necessary for the good of the country. The court emphatically rejected this argument. It pointed out that Maryland interpreted the word necessary to mean absolutely necessary, but that latter phrase was used elsewhere in the Constitution. Had the framers meant absolutely necessary in Article 1, Section 8, the court found, they would have said so, just as they did elsewhere in the document. Marshall further contended that Maryland had misunderstood the meaning of the word necessary, which imports a thing that is convenient, useful, or essential to another. He therefore read the clause as giving Congress power to do things that are helpful in carrying out its other enumerated powers. In addition, Marshall observed that the framers placed the necessary and proper clause in Article 1, Section 8, which lists Congress's powers. Had they wished the clause to limit Congress's powers, as Maryland argued, surely they would have put the clause in Article 1, Section 9, along with other limitations on congressional action. In light of all these arguments, Marshall concluded that Congress did have the power to create the bank. And because Congress could create the bank, it must also have the power to preserve the bank. If states had the authority to tax the bank, they could tax it so heavily that the bank would cease to exist. The power to tax, Marshall observed, is the power to destroy. Thus, Maryland was asserting a power hostile to federal authority. But the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution makes clear that where there's a conflict between federal law and state law, valid federal law must win. Moreover, if one state had the power to tax a federal entity, it would essentially enjoy the authority to tax people of another state, since federal entities represent all the people from all the states. This, Marshall noted, would be taxation without representation, a reference to one of the grievances that sparked the Declaration of Independence and the Revolutionary War. McCulloch v. Maryland reshaped constitutional law by asserting the predominance of federal law over state law, by making clear that Congress's powers are not limited only to what is expressly enumerated in Article 1, Section 8, and by setting a precedent of eclectic constitutional interpretation that has continued to the present. Additionally, notice how Chief Justice Marshall's opinion explicitly deferred to Congress's judgment. The court, he explained, should respect Congress's views on constitutional questions, including questions involving the scope of Congress's powers. What a contrast with Marbury. In Marbury, there was a plausible reading of the statute that would have avoided the constitutional complications altogether. In other words, the court could have construed the Judiciary Act not to confer jurisdiction over cases like Marbury's. Had it gone that route, the court wouldn't have struck down part of the act as unconstitutional and wouldn't have had reason to assert the power of judicial review or to proclaim the judiciary's authority to order executive officials to perform their duties. Instead, the court went out of its way to do both these things. So whereas McCulloch says that the court should defer to Congress's view about what is necessary and proper, Marbury is not at all deferential to Congress or the executive branch. And yet, both seminal opinions were penned by the same author. Read together, Marbury and McCulloch can be seen as demonstrating the remarkable flexibility of Marshall's legal mind. Never one to be limited by a certain mode of reasoning, Marshall used his powers of reason and persuasion to help build the Supreme Court's and the federal government's legitimacy at a time when neither enjoyed the authority they do today. But the deeper one gets into constitutional law, the more one realizes that the court vacillates between McCulloch deferential review and Marbury harder look review. Should the court review Congress with a light touch, upholding a congressional action unless it egregiously runs afoul of the Constitution, as it arguably did in McCulloch? Or should the court rigorously review Congress, construing ambiguous constitutional provisions to invalidate rather than uphold federal laws, as it arguably did in Marbury? The truth is, there are no clear rules guiding when the court reviews with more or less deference. The court often talks a good game about the importance of respecting the policy judgments of Congress, except when it doesn't. Over the next several lectures, we will examine the court's erratic sailing between these distant poles.
The legal information provided in these lectures is for informational purposes only and not for the purpose of providing legal advice. You should contact an attorney to obtain advice with respect to any particular legal issue or problem. Lecture 3. The Scope of the Executive Power.
The President of the United States is sometimes referred to as the leader of the free world, or the most powerful person on earth. But how much power does the president really have? In this lecture, we'll dig into that question and explore the constitutional limitations of executive power. To get at the issue of presidential power, we need to begin by situating the president in the context of our government more generally. As you know, the Constitution creates the three branches of our federal government. Article 1 creates the legislative branch, Congress. Article 2 creates the executive branch, the president. And Article 3 creates the judicial branch, the federal courts. As we've discussed, this structure constitutes a deliberate separation of powers. Instead of giving all power to one branch of government, the Constitution divides power up among different branches and assigns each branch different powers. One of the primary goals of our system of separation of powers is to help prevent government from becoming tyrannical. The thinking is that by separating the different functions of government, no single person or cabal can gather too much power. There are obvious advantages to this system. As I already said, this divided government helps make sure that no single public official can get too powerful. Additionally, each branch of government has its own perspective and professional norms. We probably benefit from having problems confronted by different people with different professional views, training, and expertise. Despite these advantages, there are also costs, though, to this system. The most obvious cost is inefficiency. If government needs to get various branches to move together to address a problem, then it may be difficult to address some problems quickly, especially given that the branches themselves may not be able to move that quickly, even on their own, let alone together. Of all the branches, the executive branch is best equipped to move quickly to address a national problem. Courts certainly can't. Courts are passive institutions. They don't go looking for problems to solve. Even if a judge sees a flagrantly illegal action on her way up the courthouse steps, she doesn't have the power to address it. Rather, courts have to hear the cases that come before them and decide neutrally based on the law. Congress can try to identify national problems to solve, but it can be very hard for Congress to act quickly. For congressional action to have legal force, Congress needs to pass a law that is signed by the president or override a veto. To pass a law, Congress needs a majority vote in both the Senate and the House of Representatives, and both the House and the Senate have their own complicated, arcane rules of procedure that slow things down. For example, to become law, bills usually need to move slowly through committees and subcommittees in both the House and the Senate. Each of these committees and subcommittees are veto gates where potential legislation can easily be killed or delayed by hostile politicians. Additionally, each House of Congress, as I just mentioned, has its own rules that add still more veto gates. For example, under Senate rules, the minority can use the filibuster to defeat legislation that a majority of senators want if the majority can't muster 60 votes. As a result, if the minority wants to, it can force the majority to come up with a supermajority anytime it wants to get a bill through. Legislation, in short, is very hard to pass, and increased partisan rancor makes it even harder. That leaves the executive branch, led by the president. The executive branch is the only branch of the federal government that can plausibly act quickly to deal with problems as they arise. However, when the president tries to do so, questions come up about whether the president can act in such a way. What are the president's powers? Well, Article 2 of the Constitution is very general on this point and doesn't offer a lot of helpful guidance. It does stipulate that the president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy. The president also enjoys substantial power in the field of foreign relations. Article 2 states that he can receive ambassadors, which is generally understood to mean that he can engage in negotiations and diplomacy with foreign governments. He also can make treaties, but here he shares the power with the Senate, which must provide two-thirds support. He also shares the appointment power with the Senate. He gets to appoint cabinet positions, ambassadors, and federal judges, but for each of those appointments, he must get a majority of the Senate to approve. Finally, he has the obligation to give Congress updates from time to time on the State of the Union and to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. As you can probably tell, these instructions are worded broadly, and they don't answer a lot of practical questions that the president and his staff face in this day-to-day administration of government. Incidentally, the Constitution refers to the president throughout as a he, which is what you'd expect of a document written in 1787, a period in history when women couldn't vote, let alone hold high political office. It's clear today that it would violate equal protection principles to refuse to permit a woman to serve as president. However, because the text of the Constitution uses the male pronoun he, I'll use the male pronoun too. I want to be clear, though, that in doing so, I'm not signaling that women cannot serve as president of the United States, because they clearly can. So the big question regarding the president's Article II powers is, can he act without Congress to address what he believes to be a national crisis? That is the question the Supreme Court confronted in the famous case of Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company v. Sawyer. Otherwise known as the Steel Seizure case, this litigation arose during the Korean War. In 1951, a dispute arose between steel companies and their employees over terms of a new collective bargaining agreement. Efforts to settle the dispute failed, and the Steelworkers Union gave notice of a nationwide strike. As you might expect, steel was vital to the war effort, as it was used to make weapons and vehicles. Many observers, including President Harry Truman, feared that a strike would stop steel production, which in turn would deprive American troops of the weapons and resources necessary to wage the war successfully. In response to the strike, President Truman issued an executive order directing his Secretary of Commerce, Charles Sawyer, to take possession of the steel mills and to operate them. The key question in the lawsuit that followed was whether the president could seize the steel mills in the absence of action by Congress authorizing him to do so. The president's lawyers argued that the president needed to do this to avert a national catastrophe resulting from the stoppage of steel production. Surely the nation's chief executive can take actions to protect the nation from serious problems. The president's authority to deal with national crises, they argued, is especially strong when the nation is at war, given his constitutional authority as commander-in-chief of the armed forces. The U.S. Supreme Court, however, struck down this assertion of executive authority by a 6-3 vote. President Truman, the court held, had acted unconstitutionally in seizing the steel mills. The steel seizure case is a complicated one because even the justices in the majority, that is, those who agreed the president had overstepped his authority, disagreed with one another in the reasoning they used to reach that conclusion. The view taken by Justice Hugo Black and the other justices who signed on to his majority opinion was that the president could only get the authority to take such extraordinary action from one of two sources, Congress or the Constitution. Neither source had conferred upon the president the authority to seize steel mills in this case. Congress clearly never passed a statute authorizing the president to do so. In fact, although Congress had passed two statutes authorizing the president to take property under some circumstances, those laws specified that certain conditions had to be met, and they had not been met in this case. Nor did the Constitution confer the proper authority. President Truman's lawyers had tried to argue that he had the power under Article 2, Section 3, which states that the president, quote, shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Black's opinion rejected this argument and turned it on its head. All this clause established, he wrote, was that the president was not a lawmaker. The president's role is to execute laws, not to make them. Yet in trying to seize private property, the president wasn't just carrying out existing laws, he was making new ones. Truman's lawyers also tried to argue that their boss's actions were justified under the constitutional provision stipulating that the president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy. This argument, Justice Black signaled, went too far. The president may have enhanced power in times of war, but those powers are not so enhanced that they authorize him to take possession of private property to stop a labor dispute. So to recap, Justice Black invalidated the seizure of the steel mills because he said that neither Congress nor the Constitution had conferred the president with the power to do this. Without such a conferral of power, the president can't act. A majority of the justices signed on to Justice Black's opinion. But in the years since the case, the most famous opinion was not Black's, but a concurrence written by Justice Robert Jackson. Justice Jackson agreed with Justice Black that President Truman couldn't seize the steel mills, as he had done. But Justice Jackson viewed the issue somewhat differently, and his approach provided the framework future generations of judges and lawyers would follow. Rather than viewing presidential power as a binary in which either Congress or the Constitution has conferred authority on the president, Justice Jackson articulated a somewhat more nuanced theory of executive power. He said that presidential action falls into one of three categories. The first category applies when the president acts pursuant to express or implied authorization of Congress. This is when the president's authority is at its maximum. In other words, if Congress has given the president power to do something, then the president has the most power he's going to have. In Category 1, the only way the president's action is going to be unconstitutional is if the federal government as a whole lacks the power to do what the president did. For example, it's clear that the federal government can't reinstitute segregation on the basis of race. Racial segregation clearly violates the Equal Protection Clause. So even if Congress clearly authorized the president to segregate on the basis of race, executive order to that effect would violate equal protection principles and therefore be invalid. In other words, when Congress has authorized the president to act, his power is at its zenith, but there are still limitations as to what he can do. Justice Jackson's second category applies when it's unclear whether Congress has given the necessary authority to the president. Justice Jackson explained that when the president acts in the absence of either congressional grant or denial of authority, the president must rely on his own independent powers. In such cases, there is a zone of twilight in which he and Congress may have concurrent authority or on which its distribution is uncertain. So in this category, the president's powers are neither at their strongest nor weakest, but in an uncertain middle ground. In this category, courts are going to have to look at context, history, and other factors to determine whether the president can do what he did. The third category applies when the president takes measures incompatible with the will of Congress. Here, presidential power is at its lowest because the president is violating instructions from Congress. If a court upholds presidential exercise of power in this scenario, it's also indicating that Congress cannot act on the subject. In such cases, Justice Jackson warns that courts should proceed cautiously. Notice the difference between Justice Black's and Justice Jackson's approaches. Justice Black offered a formalistic, black-and-white approach. Either the president has been given the power to do this by Congress or the Constitution, or he hasn't. By contrast, Justice Jackson's approach is more flexible. The president's power increases or decreases depending on what Congress has done, and where it isn't clear, courts should assess the relative context. Decades later, the court made Jackson's approach even more flexible. In a case called Dames and Moore v. Regan, Justice William Rehnquist, who as a young lawyer had clerked for Justice Jackson, said that his former boss's approach was best understood as a spectrum rather than as three discrete categories. This approach seems to have stuck. When lawyers and judges talk about presidential power today, they cite Jackson's famous concurrence from the Steele seizure case, but they usually apply it on a spectrum as Justice Rehnquist advocated. Notice that Justice Jackson's approach sounds straightforward enough in theory, but in practice it can be difficult to apply. How do we know whether Congress has authorized the president to do what he's done? In some cases, it'll be clear, such as when Congress explicitly authorizes the president to do something, or clearly forbids him from doing something. More often than not, however, it isn't so clear. Oftentimes, Congress has given the president authority to do something in a related area, but it hasn't spoken directly to the question at hand. Sometimes Congress has passed a relevant statute years earlier, but did not anticipate the current situation. In the Steele seizure case, Justice Jackson noted that Congress had authorized some seizures of private property, but not the one made by the president. From this background, Jackson inferred that Congress had considered granting the president the kind of power that was at issue, and had thought better of it. Consequently, Justice Jackson concluded we must be in Category 3, where Congress has rejected the authority the president asserts, and where the president's power is at its weakest. As a result, President Truman's seizure of the steel mills was unconstitutional. Jackson's explanation makes sense, but note that judges don't always read congressional action the same way. In fact, in the steel seizure case, Chief Justice Vinson dissented and basically signaled that he saw the president's seizure of the steel mills as a Category 2 case, in which Congress had not spoken clearly one way or another. After all, Congress had never passed a law saying the president couldn't do this. It had passed a law giving the president the power to take property in other contexts, but that didn't necessarily mean it meant to deny the president the power to take in this context. Congress didn't say one way or another. For this reason, Chief Justice Vinson saw this as a case of congressional silence. That is, what Justice Jackson called the zone of twilight. Given the exigencies of war, Vinson would have used this congressional silence in the president's favor and permitted Truman's seizure. Like a lot of legal cases, then, these executive power cases often boil down to questions of characterization. How do the judges characterize what Congress has done? Does the presidential action fit within the rules Congress has set forth? As you might imagine, there's a lot of leeway here for a president to insist that he has the authority to do something he wants to do, and a lot of leeway for judges to argue it either way. This, incidentally, is where lawyers add their value. When the law is clear, lawyers' arguments probably don't matter as much. But in lots of cases, the law isn't clear, or the facts aren't clear, or it's unclear how to apply the law to the facts. Those are the cases where lawyers really earn their money. And it's in those cases that the difference between a good lawyer and a bad one is especially important. Okay, so the cases we've considered establish the framework for deciding whether executive orders are constitutional. Let's say the president issues an executive order, and it's upheld by the courts. Does that mean the order has the force of law forever, and the country is just stuck with it, even if large portions of the country still oppose it? The answer is yes, the executive order has the force of law, but that doesn't mean it can't be revoked. In general, the less rigorous procedures used to put in place a new legal rule the less rigorous procedures needed to revoke that legal rule. So if a president can issue a new legal rule through executive order, that means that the next president can revoke that same rule also by executive order. In fact, when a new president takes office and replaces a president from the other political party, it's quite common for the new president early on in his administration to sign a bunch of executive orders, getting rid of some of the executive orders signed by the previous president. Also keep in mind that an executive order does not trump other pre-existing laws. For example, the president obviously cannot undo a congressional statute by executive order, though he can give instructions to his administration on how to interpret a particular statute. To that extent, as Justice Jackson explained in Steele Seizure, the legality of an executive order needs to be measured against what Congress has already done. So you may be asking yourself, is there any middle ground here? Legislation's really hard to pass and requires the support of both houses of Congress and the president. Executive orders are relatively easy to put in place, but they're vulnerable to legal challenges within the framework of the Jackson concurrence, and they're also easily undone by the next president. What else is there? The answer is administrative regulations. An enormous amount of law at both the federal and state level today is the product of action by administrative agencies. As you'll explore in greater detail in Professor Peter Smith's course on legislation and regulation, administrative agencies are departments created by Congress to deal with particular issues of policy. Congress has a lot on its plate, and it lacks the time, resources, or expertise to deal with all the kinds of problems in the country that need addressing. But Congress can pass a statute creating an administrative agency and then delegate authority to that agency to craft policy in that specific area. While some court decisions in the early 20th century struck down such delegations on the theory that the Constitution does not permit Congress to delegate its lawmaking authority, since the late 1930s, courts have upheld such delegations so long as Congress delegates with an intelligible principle, a deferential phrase that the courts have broadly understood to mean some general guidelines for the agency's job. The result is that courts now take for granted that the existence of administrative agencies is constitutional, although the particular actions of those agencies can, of course, still be challenged on legal grounds. The list of administrative agencies is far too long to recite here, but a few examples include the Environmental Protection Agency, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the State Department, the Justice Department, the National Labor Relations Board, the Commerce Department, on and on. You may ask, well, why am I talking about administrative agencies in a lecture about executive power? The reason is that presidents exercise a lot of policymaking authority through administrative agencies. The degree of presidential power over particular agencies differ, however. For example, the president's ability to influence agency policy is generally greater for executive agencies, whose heads are cabinet members. By contrast, the heads of independent agencies are not cabinet members, and in some cases, such agencies are led not by a single individual appointed by the president, but by a bipartisan commission. The president usually has at least some control over agency policy, though, and quite often it's a lot. That's why certain kinds of policy, for example, the Justice Department's stance on civil rights or the Environmental Protection Agency's attitudes towards greenhouse gases, often change depending on the party of the person occupying the White House. Administrative agencies can create policy in various ways, but one of the most important and common is through a process known as notice and comment rulemaking. This is the process agencies usually use to promulgate new regulations, which have the force of binding law. To do so, the agency needs to give notice of a proposed rulemaking and then give interested parties time to comment on the proposed rule. So, for example, when the Environmental Protection Agency considers promulgating a new rule, it will post an announcement in a publication called the Federal Register. The agency then must permit a public comment period, which allows interested parties, such as businesses that would be affected by the new regulation, environmental groups, and ordinary citizens. It allows all of them to explain why they think the proposed rule is a good idea or a bad idea. After the comment period, the agency publishes its response to the public comments, essentially explaining its reasons for following or rejecting them, and decides whether or not to issue a final rule. As you might expect, the president is usually not involved in the nitty-gritty of the notice and comment rulemaking process, but he plays a large role in setting the agency's agenda. For example, the president may instruct the agency about how much he wants it to regulate, about what he wants the agency to focus on, and so forth. Sometimes the president wants an agency to change course from its past practice. To get rid of existing regulations, however, an agency usually needs to go through the same process that was used to promulgate the regulation in the first place. In other words, as with a statute and an executive order, administrative rules can be replaced or repealed, but generally only by using the same process with which they were adopted, or a more onerous one. As a result, the president can't undo, say, a statute with a mere executive order. As a result of all this, the president has a good deal of power over agency policy, but that power is not absolute. He can help set the agency's agenda and instruct the political appointees at the agency of the administration's priorities. However, the president cannot force the agency to sidestep the procedures, such as notice and comment rulemaking, which are often mandated by law. Additionally, given relatively robust judicial review of agency action under the 1946 Administrative Procedure Act, agency actions that fail to comply with these requirements can be invalidated by courts. So just how much power does the president have? In spite of the legal framework that the courts have established to address this question, the scope of executive authority remains difficult to pin down because both the Constitution and the Administrative Procedure Act are short in detail. We know that courts can review administrative agency actions to make sure that agencies have followed proper procedures, but how deferential should courts be to agencies? We know that under Justice Jackson's approach, presidents are in a middle ground when Congress has neither authorized nor forbidden executive action. But how should courts resolve cases that fall into this so-called zone of twilight? Such questions are difficult, but exceptionally important. American presidents have asserted more and more power through the generations. As they keep pushing to expand their domain, courts and lawyers have a bigger role to play in making sure that the country strikes the proper legal balance between giving the chief executive enough authority to deal with urgent national issues on the one hand, while ensuring that he doesn't abuse his power on the other. This balance is difficult to strike well, especially in times of war or terrorism, when the threat to national security looms especially large, but where the possibility of executive overreach seems especially likely. Indeed, when presidents are on thin legal ice, they often cite national security in the hopes of justifying controversial exercises of power. Courts therefore often have to make difficult judgment calls about whether the national security situation is as dangerous as the president claims. These are tough calls for judges to make. On the one hand, few judges are national security experts, and most recognize that the president is likely to understand the threats to the nation far better than judges do. On the other hand, most judges also realize that they cannot give the president carte blanche to do whatever he wants merely because his lawyers say they're doing it to protect the national security. Such an approach could lead to a dangerous expansion of presidential power. Though the framers didn't give us many clear instructions in Article II, the historical record shows that they were concerned about leaders who wielded too much power. After all, the founders fought the American Revolution in part to free themselves from what they perceived to be the tyrannical rule of King George III. When courts review the legality of executive action, then, they must not lose sight of the possibility and danger of executive overreach. Of course, federal power isn't limited to the president and the judiciary. The Constitution vests the authority to make laws in Congress. So to understand the scope of federal power, we must also consider how the Constitution allocates authority to Congress. That's the topic we'll turn to next time.
The legal information provided in these lectures is for informational purposes only and not for the purpose of providing legal advice. You should contact an attorney to obtain advice with respect to any particular legal issue or problem. Lecture 4, Congress and the New Deal Commerce Clause.
The power of the United States Congress, like the powers of the other branches of government we have already considered, is set forth in the Constitution. Yet Congress's power as we know it today was shaped in significant part in the 1930s, in one of the most important and sudden constitutional transformations in American history. This change was about federalism, the critical division between state and federal power that has caused fierce controversy throughout U.S. history and continues to do so today. And it was sweeping in its effect. It expanded the scope of federal power dramatically and immediately. To understand how it came about, we need to go back to the nation's early days. At the time of the Declaration of Independence in 1776, the colonies turned states conceived of themselves more as independent sovereign nations than as a single unified country. The states did join together in a Continental Congress that ostensibly governed relations among them, but that wasn't really a government. Though the Continental Congress did exercise some power, such as in establishing an army, its authority was very limited. And as the Revolutionary War against Great Britain continued, Americans realized that they might need some kind of legitimate central authority to help share the expenses of the war. They also needed help minimizing conflicts between the colonies turned states. The Continental Congress ultimately adopted the Articles of Confederation for this purpose in 1777. But by its own terms, each state had to ratify the articles for them to take effect, and that didn't occur until 1781. This fact alone illustrates the difficulty the states had in cooperating with one another. Indeed, the Articles of Confederation emphasized just how little power resided with the centralized government. One provision of the Articles explained that the states were entering into a firm league of friendship with each other. This provision suggests that the Articles of Confederation was not really a constitution, but instead more like a treaty among allies. We've already seen in Lecture 1 how the Articles of Confederation failed to elicit enough cooperation among the states for the young nation to function effectively. The Constitution that was drafted by the delegates to the convention in Philadelphia in 1787 was designed to address this problem by establishing a stronger central government. But there is great debate about how much stronger. One reason for the controversy is that the Constitution's framers spent lots of time debating other issues, like representation. Another reason is that the text of the Constitution doesn't offer clear guidance. Article 1 of the Constitution creates Congress, and it gives the power to make federal laws to Congress. But Article 1 also enumerates Congress's powers. As a result, the argument goes, the Constitution does not grant Congress unlimited power to legislate as it sees fit. Instead, the Constitution lists specific powers that Congress has. Congress can pass laws only pursuant to those enumerated powers. If the Constitution does not delegate to Congress a particular power, then Congress doesn't have it. Support for this view can be found in the fact that the convention initially agreed to give Congress broader, open-ended powers, but the Committee of Detail, which wrote the first draft of the Constitution, changed the document to list the enumerated powers we have today. Those who believe the framers envisioned a more powerful Congress, however, note that the Constitution nowhere specifically states that Congress is strictly limited to exercising only those powers that Article 1 expressly enumerates. Some scholars, like Richard Primus of Michigan Law School, have argued that the mere fact of enumeration does not necessarily mean that Congress cannot exercise other powers for the country's good. The scope of congressional power on this view depends on context and contingency. Congress's powers will sometimes be limited, but not by the mere fact of enumeration alone. Opponents of this position contend that the 10th Amendment stipulates otherwise. That amendment states that if the Constitution does not grant a specific power to the federal government, then that power lies with the state governments or the people. Of course, this argument only takes us so far because it does not tell us how broadly to read the powers that the Constitution does grant to the federal government. If Congress's enumerated powers are construed broadly, then the federal government will enjoy tremendous power, notwithstanding the 10th Amendment's limitations. By contrast, if we construe those powers narrowly, then much governmental authority will reside not with the federal government, but the states. In all events, you might be wondering, what are some of Congress's enumerated powers? Well, here are a few. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution grants Congress numerous powers, including the power to lay and collect taxes, to pay the nation's debts, to provide for the common defense and the general welfare, to coin money, to establish post offices, to declare war, and to raise and support armies. It also includes the Commerce Clause, which grants Congress the power to regulate commerce among the several states. Article 1, Section 8 also gives Congress the power to make all laws necessary and proper for carrying out its other powers, as we talked about in an earlier lecture. Now, the Supreme Court's approach to the Commerce Clause through the first 130 years of our history was haphazard. The first major Supreme Court case to interpret the clause was Gibbons v. Ogden in 1824. Gibbons arose out of a conflict involving the right to operate a ferry boat in the waters around New York City. The New York legislature had granted a monopoly for operating steamboats in New York waters to two men named Fulton and Livingston. That meant no one could operate a ferry boat in New York waters without a license from one of these two guys. Well, Fulton and Livingston had sold a license to Aaron Ogden to operate a ferry between New York City and Elizabethtown Port in New Jersey. However, a guy named Thomas Gibbons also operated a ferry service between those ports, and he didn't have a license from Fulton and Livingston. So Ogden brought a lawsuit to stop Gibbons' ferry operation on the theory that it violated Ogden's monopoly. Gibbons, in return, argued that his ferries were properly licensed under a federal law, which permitted federal licensing of vessels to be employed in the coasting trade. Under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, valid federal law trumps conflicting, otherwise valid state law. So a key question in the case was whether the federal law was valid, that is, whether it fit within Congress's commerce power. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Gibbons' favor and held that the federal law did authorize Gibbons to operate a ferry in New York. In so doing, it concluded that that federal law was within the scope of the commerce power. The federal law, therefore, was valid and overrode the New York monopoly. The unanimous decision was written by the famous Chief Justice John Marshall, and it defined commerce broadly. Whereas Ogden's lawyer had argued that commerce was limited to buying or selling commodities, Chief Justice Marshall concluded that commerce also includes what he called intercourse, which encompasses the various phases of business, not just buying and selling. Commerce therefore included, among other things, navigation, such as that of the ferry boats at issue in this case. Congress's commerce power, the Chief Justice continued, includes the power to regulate, and it's a broad power that Congress may exercise in its discretion. Gibbons v. Ogden then indicated that Congress has substantial federal power under the Commerce Clause. Later in the 19th century, however, the court tended to adopt a narrower view of federal power and a narrower construction of the Commerce Clause. Indeed, in the late 1800s and continuing into the 1930s, the Supreme Court repeatedly invalidated federal laws on the theory that they went beyond Congress's commerce power. These decisions criticize Congress for trying to legislate on matters that should be left to the states. Many Supreme Court justices during this period also believed in laissez-faire economics and thought it was the court's job to protect business from governmental economic regulations. For example, in 1918, in a case called Hammer v. Dagenhart, the court struck down a federal statute seeking to protect child laborers by prohibiting the transportation of goods made by child labor. The court's theory, in a nutshell, was that the production of goods occurs locally. It's therefore up to state governments, not the federal government, to determine whether kids can be put to work. Notice the court's focus on the matter of production. Even though the goods produced by children may ultimately travel in interstate commerce, the court reasoned, Congress's power did not reach the labor used to produce such goods. The court warned that if Congress could pass such a law, it would destroy the division between federal and state governments by intruding on the state's prerogative to pass laws dealing with local matters like labor conditions. This interpretation of the Commerce Clause still dominated the court in the early 1930s. Following the stock market crash of October 29, 1929, the country spiraled into the Great Depression. People lost their jobs, and many Americans plunged into poverty. By 1932, unemployment had reached 25%, and it remained above 16% until 1936. To put these numbers into some perspective, during the Great Recession that began in late 2007, unemployment peaked at about 10% in 2009. Franklin D. Roosevelt was elected president in 1932 with a mandate for action and action now. President Roosevelt spearheaded an unprecedented wave of legislation designed to revive the struggling economy, protect workers, and ease the crushing effects of poverty. As you may know, Roosevelt referred to these programs collectively as the New Deal. Unsurprisingly, big business lawyers challenged these new laws as beyond the scope of the federal government's constitutional powers. Congress had justified its new laws under the Commerce Clause, so the court, once again, needed to interpret that provision. One of the most famous cases from this era was ALA Schechter Poultry Corporation, the United States. The case centered around the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933, which was part of the New Deal. It authorized the president to promulgate codes regarding minimum wages, maximum hours, collective bargaining, and unfair trade practices. And the law made it a crime for an employer to violate any code provision. The Schechter Poultry case involved Schechter's Brooklyn Chicken Slaughterhouse, which was found to violate the wage and hour provisions of the code. The Schechter Poultry Corporation argued that the federal law could not constitutionally regulate its slaughterhouse because the chickens were killed and sold in New York and did not cross state lines. As a result, argued the company, the chickens were never in interstate commerce. Therefore, labor conditions at the slaughterhouse went beyond Congress's constitutional powers. The court agreed with the corporation and rejected the federal government's argument that it could regulate labor practices at the slaughterhouse. Though many of the chickens originated out of New York State, the court held that the interstate transaction ended when the chickens got to Brooklyn. Once the chickens arrived, they were slaughtered and sold locally. As a result, the court concluded the slaughterhouse was beyond Congress's regulatory reach. The Schechter Poultry case was not unusual. In other cases, too, the Supreme Court invalidated New Deal legislation, emphasizing that the Commerce Clause only empowered Congress to regulate goods or activity that were actually in interstate commerce, such as buying or selling items across state lines. Activities like mining, harvesting, and manufacturing goods all occurred locally in the court's eyes, before the goods entered the stream of commerce. As you might expect, the Roosevelt administration did not react favorably to these Supreme Court decisions. In FDR's eyes, the Great Depression presented a national crisis. He argued that the court should not interfere with the federal government's efforts to improve the economy and protect workers. The president also thought the Supreme Court was hopelessly out of step with the American public, which craved legislative action to solve the country's serious problems. The court, as the president saw it, was unfairly using its power to help big business in its exploitation of vulnerable blue-collar workers. After his landslide 1936 re-election, Roosevelt decided to take matters into his own hands by proposing his now infamous court packing scheme. The scheme worked like this. The Constitution grants federal judges life tenure, so President Roosevelt couldn't fire any justices. However, the Constitution does not set the number of Supreme Court justices. Over the years, the number of justices has ranged from 6 to 10. So President Roosevelt came up with the idea to pack the court with new justices sympathetic to the New Deal. More specifically, he proposed that Congress pass a law permitting the president to appoint a new justice for each current justice over the age of 70. Now, at the time, 6 of the 9 justices met that criterion. And moreover, 4 of those 6, nicknamed the Four Horsemen, were committed conservatives who believed in very limited federal power. The court packing plan would have allowed President Roosevelt to add enough justices of his own to outvote the Four Horsemen. Despite Roosevelt's popularity, his court packing scheme met fierce criticism. As Harvard Law professor Noah Feldman explains, it seemed like a brazen attempt to change the balance of powers among the branches of government. To FDR's enemies, the plans confirmed their worst fears that Roosevelt was a dictator in waiting. Even to his allies, it was a bad case of presidential overreach. And to all the justices on the Supreme Court, it was an outrageous political interference into the court's business of interpreting and applying the law. Congress ultimately refused to adopt the court packing plan. In retrospect, the plan appears to have been a bad political miscalculation by a man who was usually so politically shrewd. Roosevelt, however, would claim that he may have lost the battle, but he won the war. And he may have been right. Later that same year, in 1937, the Supreme Court began upholding the very kinds of economic legislation that in 1936 it had been striking down. The case of National Labor Relations Board v. Jones and Laughlin Steel Corporation epitomizes this switch. This case involved the National Labor Relations Act. Also known as the Wagner Act, this law created a right of employees to bargain collectively. Because the Supreme Court had been hostile to similar laws in recent years, businesses basically ignored the law, figuring that the courts would strike it down as unconstitutional. They figured wrong. The federal government charged the Jones and Laughlin Steel Corporation with unfair labor practices because it fired employees who had tried to form a union. The key legal issue was whether Congress had the power under the Commerce Clause to pass the Wagner Act. Despite ample precedent to the contrary, the court, in a 5-4 decision, said that Congress did have that power under the Commerce Clause. The court's reasoning is at odds with earlier cases like Schechter Poultry. First, the court emphasized that Jones and Laughlin was a major player in the steel business. It was the 4th largest producer of steel in the country, with factories, mines, and other operations spread across several states. Jones and Laughlin's business then quite obviously impacted interstate commerce. Nevertheless, this point marked a break from earlier cases. The court had previously indicated that the size of the relevant business was not really a factor in the constitutional analysis. Now it was. Second, and even more importantly, the court explained that the fact that the relevant labor laws involved the production of steel did not matter. In previous cases, as we've seen, the court had typically distinguished between commerce, the buying and selling of goods across state lines, and production of goods, such as manufacturing or mining. The court had usually treated labor laws related to the production of goods as a local matter, beyond Congress's reach. Recall that labor conditions at Schechter's slaughterhouse were treated as local, even though many of the chickens had come from out of state. In the Jones and Laughlin Steel case, the court declared that the fact that the employees were engaged in production is not determinative. Whereas earlier cases had treated production as outside the stream of commerce, the Supreme Court now asked a different question. Do the regulated activities have a close and substantial relation to interstate commerce? In other words, even if steel production happens locally in a factory in say, Pennsylvania, might labor strife at that factory have far-flung economic effects in other states? The obvious answer to this question was yes. The steel industry crossed state lines, so labor unrest in a Pennsylvania factory could most certainly have economic effects elsewhere in the nation. Any other conclusion, reasoned Chief Justice Hughes, could only be reached in an intellectual vacuum. So the Jones and Lachlan Steel case signaled a major shift in the Supreme Court's thinking. And the court's switch was not limited to major national corporations. Another 1937 case also upheld the Wagner Act's application to a small clothing manufacturer. Suddenly, in the court's eyes, lots of activity could affect interstate commerce and therefore could be subject to federal regulation. This dramatic interpretive change is sometimes known as the switch in time that saved nine. That's because after the court switched direction and started upholding economic regulations, Roosevelt's court packing plan seemed unnecessary. The Supreme Court would remain a court with nine and only nine justices. Now, historians disagree about whether the court packing plan actually prompted the switch in time. Some think that the swing justice in some of these cases, Justice Owen Roberts, caved in the face of presidential pressure. Others point out that the justices had cast their votes in West Coast Hotel v. Parrish, a key case about judicial deference to economic regulations that, in retrospect, foreshadowed changes to the court's approach in the Commerce Clause area before the president had announced the plan. From this perspective, the switch might have happened anyway. In all events, the switch was an enormous change to Congress's role in our government. Seemingly overnight, Congress's power to pass laws dealing with labor relations and other economic matters went from being very limited to pretty broad. And in the years to come, it would become even broader. President Roosevelt did not have the opportunity to appoint a single justice to the Supreme Court during his first term. But by 1937, the Four Horsemen and several other justices were old men, and many would soon retire or die. In the next few years, President Roosevelt, who served longer than any other president before or since, would completely remake the court without having to resort to court packing at all. By the time of his own death in 1945, Roosevelt had appointed eight new justices, including four of the most important to ever sit on the bench: Hugo Black, Felix Frankfurter, William Douglas, and Robert Jackson. Incidentally, these justices disagreed with each other often, and some of them grew to hate each other intensely. But the one thing they all agreed on was that it was not the court's place to interfere with Congress's economic policies. This was no accident. FDR had been careful to appoint committed New Dealers to the court, and his justices made sure that the switch in time was not a short-lived aberration. Indeed, in 1942, the court articulated an even more robust vision of Congress's commerce authority in Wickard v. Filburn. In an effort to stabilize low and volatile agricultural commodity prices, Congress had passed the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938. The act set a quota for the amount of wheat produced by each farmer. The government had found that the nation's total supply of wheat was far more than what was needed for both domestic consumption and for export. Wheat prices were very low because supply far exceeded demand. Congress figured that they could help farmers out by limiting supply, which would force the price for wheat to rise. Congress therefore gave each farmer an allotment, that is, a limit to the amount of wheat each could grow. As you might expect, though Congress's intentions were to help farmers, many did not respond kindly to this plan. Roscoe Filburn owned a dairy farm in Ohio, but he also grew some wheat, which he used for livestock, for home consumption, and for sale. In 1941, Filburn was allotted 223 bushels of wheat, but he grew 462. The government penalized him, and he sued the Secretary of Agriculture, challenging the constitutionality of the scheme. The lawsuit focused on the wheat Filburn's family and animals consumed on his farm. Filburn's primary constitutional argument was that because the wheat in question never left